Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, now in depth on what they say they'll do, what they really will do.
We're going to have strong, incredible borders, and people are going to come into our country, but they're going to come into our country legally.
Because I think we have to get to comprehensive immigration reform with a path to citizenship.
I would bomb the hell out of ISIS.
Finally need to pass a prohibition on anyone who's on the terrorist watch list from being able to buy a gun in our country. If you're too dangerous to fly, you are too dangerous to buy a gun.
We are going to make America great again.
Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump have been making promises to the American people from the moment they announced their campaigns many, many tumultuous months ago. Here's the question. How do they prioritize those promises in the early days of their administration? What do they do when they encounter obstacles, as every president does, to fulfilling those promises? Today, 7 days out before Election Day, a 90-minute conversation about what Clinton or Trump want and can get done as they begin their presidencies. And here's where I hope you'll come in. Which of those promises and important issues do you want the new president to prioritize? Do you want them to lead with immigration, figure out health care, do something about trade policy, create a plan to vanquish ISIS? Which of the promises and commitments that you've heard the presidential candidates making do you want them to put at the top of the to-do list? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Online, nprnews.org/live. I've tweeted a question out about it on Twitter. It's at Carrie NPR. Later, we'll talk with Reed Galen and Daniela Gibbs-Ledger, who have both served presidents, but we're beginning with two journalists who've been thinking and writing about it. Mark Fisher is a senior editor at The Washington Post and co-author of Trump Revealed, and he's with us from D.C. And Mark, welcome to the show. Good to have you here.
Good to be with you.
Russell Berman is with us. He's a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, and he's with us today from New York City. And Russell, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you.
And Mark, that sounded like a deep sigh, like you are very ready for this campaign to end. Is that
well,
true?
Well, it's been a long run. Well, it's, you know, certainly this is everything that we've all been building up to. So there's a certain excitement, but also a certain level of, I think, almost despair that I sense among voters on both sides.
And despair, why?
Well, there's a certain unhappiness, obviously, with both of these candidates, an almost record lack of enthusiasm among both Democrats and Republicans, independents as well. And so there's also a certain degree of nervousness about, and this is really from across the board. I did a story a couple weeks ago on the people who are gathered outside the Clinton and Trump headquarters in New York City. And although there are some enthusiasts outside Trump's headquarters, outside Clinton's headquarters, I couldn't find anyone, even among those who are planning to vote for her, who was really enthusiastic about it. So
wow.
It's an unusual election in that way.
Yeah, Russell, would you concur with that just from your reporting as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a sense of both of get it over with already and, you know, either candidate, if they win, I think will go in with much lower expectations about what they can get done than President Obama did 8 years ago. Certainly Hillary Clinton. If Donald Trump wins, obviously it would be a big surprise at this point, given the polling over the last several weeks. But, you know, for Hillary Clinton, you know, working with the Republican Congress, I think the level of enthusiasm is related to what people expect might actually change and what might actually get done if Hillary is elected.
So I think this is an important point, Russell, and it goes back. You mentioned President Obama, and there was all this enthusiasm, and there was this sense that there was a mandate. He had a Democratic Congress, and he still struggled to get. He had to pick and choose. He struggled to get what he wanted to get done. Remember health care, the ACA that we're all talking about again, how close that ended up being?
Exactly. And he had a long list of things to get done. that he wanted to do. And but people were expecting sort of the earth to shift almost based on the sheer amount of change that he was promising
right.
from the Bush administration. And so in one respect, I think talking about if Hillary Clinton wins, she could benefit a little bit from the fact that expectations would be so low. They're not expecting her to pass some major climate change legislation. They're not expecting her to pass some major new health care reform. Maybe if she could, you know, get Republicans to agree to some fixes to health care, even immigration, which has been maybe one of the only major policy areas that's been discussed in detail in this campaign, it's unclear what she's going to be able to do. So the expectations are going to be lower, but it's still going to be difficult to get really anything done.
Mark, how is it that lower expectations might actually produce some results with Congress, depending on the makeup, and we think it'll be close no matter how it turns out?
Well, obviously, we have, going into the next administration, a Republican Party that is deeply damaged and divided. Whether Trump wins or loses, the Republicans have a near civil war kind of situation that they're facing within their ranks, both in terms of who's in Congress and then in the larger sense in terms of what the message and sort of purpose of the Republican Party may be. And so you're going to have factions that are fighting that out even as a new president tries to set an agenda and get some things done. So will there be a continued paralysis that we've seen that has so frustrated voters across the country? Or will some Republicans come together and say, you know, we've got to show that we're able to get something done? You have a lot of members of Congress now who are elected expressly to resist
right.
the kind of compromise that is necessary to build majorities. And so whichever candidate wins the presidency is going to have very difficult time trying to get anything through. And that's why we see presidents, especially the last two, moving toward this kind of unilateral action that Donald Trump is very much promising to continue down that road.
Yeah, I want to talk about those executive orders a little later. But we have a lot of voters on the phone lines here and on Twitter who have their ideas about what ought to be prioritized. So to Christine in St. Paul. Christine, what makes it to the top of the new president's list for you?
Definitely immigration reform.
And tell me why.
Well, we happen to be a mixed status family, and so I think while things like health care affect sort of the fringes of life, for a lot of folks out there, immigration affects kind of the core of decisions and freedoms that our family is able to respond to because of our situation.
Do you, Christine, when you say mixed status, does that mean that there are some people in your household that don't have permanent status, citizenship in the United States at the moment?
Yep.
Okay. I'm glad you brought this up. Russell, to you on this, as Christine suggests, this is something that both of the candidates have been talking a lot about. Are you persuaded that what Republicans have been seeing as far as voters that care about this issue and where they're lining up, often behind Democrats, may come back to this issue as they wanted to after 2012?
I think there's certainly going to be a big effort. Again, certainly Hillary Clinton has promised, if she wins, to make this a priority in the first 100 days. And it's going to be a big decision, again, as it was in 2013, for Republicans in Congress as to whether they sort of play ball and try to work with her or just resist from the outset. And that, as Mark was mentioning, there's a lot of internal politics within the Republican Party that's going to determine whether they do that, particularly in the House of Representatives, where Paul Ryan, you know, he needs to get the votes to remain Speaker if Republicans control the House. He wants to do immigration reform, but, you know, the people who might oppose him for Speaker might oppose him based on the fear that he will work with Clinton on this issue. So there's clearly going to be a legislative push if Clinton wins, but she also has promised to try to go even further than President Obama did on executive action. And so she may move more quickly to executive action, which would put the issue essentially back into the courts if Republicans do not cooperate in any respect on immigration.
Mark.
And of course,
I was just going to say, Mark, one of the things that House Republicans did when it came to immigration was they wanted to break it into pieces, right? And what ended up happening with that was that nothing, none of those individual pieces got passed, and so then President Obama started signing these executive orders. Do you sense that, having seen that there was no movement on that, and having this back out there as a key campaign issue, may have changed some minds about that strategy?
Well, it's possible, and certainly the way this campaign has gone may have changed some minds within the Republican Party. You know, you have this deep division in the party now, and so there, if Paul Ryan manages to hold on to his speakership, and if there is a reasonable number of folks in the House who say, you know, we need to go back to the playbook that we set up after the 2012 loss and reach out to Hispanic voters and send a message that Republicans are not going to allow their party to be identified purely as the anti-non-white people in this country party, then you might begin to see the beginnings of a coalition that could come up with some kind of a compromise on immigration. But there are a lot of ifs in that paragraph, and they start with if Hillary Clinton is elected. Although I should say that Donald Trump has told us during our interviews with him that he wants to be unpredictable even on immigration. And although
really?
He's not backing away from build that wall, he is very much open to the idea of immigration reform. And, you know, he likes to surprise people. He likes to be seen as a conservative and then veer left and be seen as a liberal and then veer right. So it's not entirely out of the realm of possibility that if he were to win, he would be part of that coalition to come up with an immigration reform package of some sort.
This is special coverage, if you've just tuned in, 1 week out from Election Day, and we're contemplating, among all of the promises that the candidates have made on the campaign trail, and there are a lot of them, how Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump would prioritize those commitments? What kinds of obstacles would they confront in Congress? Would they turn to some of the measures that President Obama has used when he's run into barriers on his agenda? And then asking you this morning about how you want these new this new president to prioritize these commitments. Do you put doing something about the Affordable Care Act at the top of that list? Do you put immigration at the top of that list? What about the trade plan, trade policy? Donald Trump talks a lot about that on the campaign trail and gets a lot of support for making alterations in it. What about creating a plan to vanquish ISIS? Is that first and foremost on a new president's agenda? 651-227-6000-800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, to the phones to Mary in Minneapolis. Hi, Mary.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I'm concerned about health care. Obamacare is going up by double digits this year. I know Governor Dayton has promised some money for assistance to people who are on it, but there is a maximum on that amount, too. I'm on Social Security, and I have Medicare, and it doesn't pay for glasses or dental work. I just had to put out $50 a month for Delta Dental so I could get dental work done. It's a real problem for a lot of people.
Did you say you're on Medicare, Mary?
Yes.
I don't think whatever happens with the ACA would affect you, would it?
Probably not.
But it's something you're concerned about.
Well, absolutely, because I just had to put $50 I can't afford out for Delta Dental. I have to pay out of my pocket for glasses. There's the whole issue of Obamacare and going up double-digit inflation, or double-digit numbers. As I said, Governor Dayton has agreed to kick in some money, but there's a maximum on that. I think it's a serious problem.
Russell, have you heard the kind of detailed discussion on the campaign trail that gives you a sense about what Clinton or Trump, Donald Trump has said he wants to repeal it. Other than that,
right,
are you hearing specifics about how each of them would handle health care?
Well, on the Republican side, you know, the Republicans finally have put out some specifics on the House side with the Paul Ryan's A Better Way agenda. They do have a health care plan in there. It's not specific legislation, but it's more detailed than they've done. It's similar to Republican plans from the past going all the way to George W. Bush in terms of they would obviously, as they've promised repeatedly, repeal. They would start by repealing the Affordable Care Act, and then they would work to replace it with increased tax credits for people. And obviously that would be difficult even if Republicans win a narrow majority in the Senate and the White House. As for Hillary Clinton, the big thing is going to be an effort to try to fix what's wrong with Obamacare in terms of the rising premiums that we've seen and the sort of lack of a mix of healthy people in the exchanges. And that's going to depend on whether Republicans, after this election, having lost a third presidential election in a row, will agree to try to fix the law as opposed to just wanting to repeal it. And that's going to be a big question, and we don't know the answer to that.
For listeners interested in the health care policy, and you might have missed our conversation yesterday at 9, you can find it on the podcast. We were talking about why premiums are going up and some ideas about reform for that. Mark, what's your sense about how urgent health care reform is going to be for a Clinton or Trump presidency?
Well, in the case of Trump, this is one of the many ways in which he has campaigned more by slogan than by policy. And so the idea of build that wall or repeal Obamacare, you know, when you hear him say things like I alone can fix this, you think he's really going to dive in and address these issues. But when you press both the people in the campaign and many of his supporters at rallies, they hear in these slogans not really a policy prescription so much as a reflection of popular frustration. They hear Donald Trump saying the things that they believe in that they want a president to take care of, but they don't really expect that he's going to do anything on it. And I think in Clinton's case, she very much wants to do something about health care and has, you know, the opposite approach, one filled with lots of specifics on her website and all of that. But again, it's a question of is this what she would put first on her agenda? And I really don't see a path to that, given that it's almost certain to be a divided Congress.
Yeah, I was just thinking of something that Russell alluded to, Mark, which was this idea. You know, there are people who are not happy with the rising premiums, but they are happy that their 21-year-old college student gets covered. And, you know, I mean, people, I think, feel ambivalent about parts of it and may not go along with the idea that it has to be repealed. And so I think, as Russell suggested, doesn't the Republican, if it's leadership in the House and the Senate, have to confront that as well?
Well, yes. I mean, anything that you would want to do that would alter Obamacare or improve it piecemeal would require close cooperation between the White House and Congress. And I can't imagine there's anyone in the country left who really believes that that's likely to happen in the next year or so, particularly on a tough issue like health care. So there are certain things that a president can do almost by fiat, but there are certain things such as repealing or replacing the Affordable Care Act that really would require a level of cooperation and detail work that we haven't seen out of Congress and the White House in years.
Kelia says on Twitter, I'm a Clinton supporter, but I'm dismayed that she and Democrats championing the blatantly unconstitutional no-fly, no-gun proposal. To the phones to Joy in Cannon Falls. Hi, Joy. How are you seeing this?
Yeah, hi. This is a great conversation. Thanks. I can't help but think that as I was mulling over my comment, that it keeps getting reinforced as you go to each caller and as you go back to your guests. What I was going to say is that I think as an American and as somebody who's really watched politics over the last 20 years, watching this Congress over the last 8 has been an education in obstruction. And I honestly don't have any belief that this Congress will cooperate with, and I really think it's going to be Hillary Clinton who's going to win this, but I mean, it could be Donald Trump. But if Hillary Clinton is elected and the House goes to Republicans, as looks pretty likely, they have no incentive to cooperate. And although your guest said that, you know, the Republican Party is going to have to do some soul searching,
right?
They've got, you know, their base is 30-40% of the people who, you know, support Trump very strongly, and they are not going to, they're not going to go quietly, and they're not going to let the party, you know, move to the left. So who's this constituency that's going to rebuild the Republican Party?
I'm sorry,
I don't mean to be so cynical.
But Joy, I think you've raised some good questions. We have a number of other people that want to speak here, and I want to come back to Russell on your question. Russell, let's draw that out a little bit more. What is the incentive for Republicans as they do this soul searching to take stock and maybe decide that they have to show some amount of progress, even with a Democratic president?
Well, there's still in Congress is a significant portion of Republicans who want to govern, who want to show that the Republican Party can govern. Over the last several years, even when Republicans have done well in the elections, like in 2010 and 2014, the favorability ratings for the party are very low. People do not hold the Republican Party in high standing. And they are facing that this election may bear out a demographic issue going forward. And so I think there's going to be a lot of pressure from at least half of the party to shift gears, to show that they can work in some way with the Democrats if it's divided government, to at least raise the standing of the party to put it on a better footing for future elections.
Mark, do you buy that?
Well, yeah, I think Russell is right. And I think, you know, there are some Republicans, a good number that we saw after the 2012 loss, who said we can't go on like this.
Right.
And we can't, you know, the idea of 4 or 8 more years of pure obstruction and paralysis, that doesn't help either party. And I think we saw in this primary process among the Republicans the proof of that, because the people who were presenting the more reasonable or moderate kinds of approaches were essentially laughed out of the race. So the Republicans have their issue about compromise versus ideological purity, and they're going to have to kind of battle that out. But there's a larger issue here about Congress at writ large,
mm-hmm.
and the whole question of how weak Congress has become in this battle for power between the White House and Congress. And a number of Congress members say now that it's time for Congress to step up. Senator Mike Lee, Republican from Utah, said that the constitutional order that our founders set up has broken down, and that if Congress continues to not push back against these presidential, unilateral presidential actions, then it doesn't matter whether you're Republican or Democrat. There's just no check on presidential power. And I think there is quite a large group of people in Congress who are at least beginning to realize that they need to step up in some way.
Well, so let me make sure I understand what you're saying. Congress has been weakened by its own gridlock, by its own inability to get anything done. Is that how that goes?
Well, it's both gridlock, but I think even beyond the gridlock, it's the idea that Congress has allowed a series of presidents of both parties to rule by executive order, executive action, all of these powers that presidents have assumed over the last few decades. And it really, Congress hasn't pushed back since the 1970s when we saw a series of actions, the War Powers Act, the Intelligence Oversight Act, all of these ways in which Congress tried to rebalance the power between Congress and the executive. Those acts didn't turn out to have a lot of teeth to them, but there at least was a tension there. And now it seems that the presidents, particularly the last two, have been able to essentially put out executive actions, administrative actions, and so on virtually everything they want, and only the courts are pushing back.
Russell, two questions for you on that. Do you agree that Congress has been weakened by its inability to push back on these executive orders? And when Donald Trump says, as he has, that his first day in office, which will be a Saturday after the inaugural, he's going to repeal every single Obama executive order. Can he do that?
Well, to the second question, certainly he can take his own executive actions and orders that would undo a lot of what Obama has done through executive orders. He could change policy throughout the administration, direct his new cabinet, for example, to change the enforcement priorities in the Department of Homeland Security, reversing what Obama did a couple of years ago. And that's, frankly, something that presidents in both parties have done early on. They issue a number of executive orders on the first few days in office, and some of them overwrite what previous presidents have done. Now, to your other question, I think it's indisputable that Congress's power relative to the White House and the executive branch has weakened. They've left a vacuum by their inability to take action. But one thing about that is that a lot of that has moved to the courts. So we saw the Republicans in Congress respond to President Obama's executive actions increasingly by bringing lawsuits, whether at the state level or in the case of the House of Representatives itself. And I think that will continue if President Clinton tries to repeat what President Obama did. And that sort of brings us back to the Supreme Court and whether President Clinton will be able to fill that ninth seat with an ally or sort of a favorable, more liberal vote than Antonin Scalia was. And that's where we can see, where we might see that issue decided if Congress continues to be stuck in gridlock and really tries to win in the courts, yeah, not in the legislature.
I want to come back to the Supreme Court in a second, but if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Russell Berman. He's a senior associate editor at The Atlantic, and Mark Fisher, a senior editor at The Washington Post, co-author of Trump Revealed, as we have a conversation about prioritizing for the new president. Lots of promises made on the campaign trail. Getting in office, part of beginning that new administration, is deciding what to focus on first. We're talking with our guests about that, but also you, listening to you say, well, I'm a voter and I care about these promises that these candidates have made, and I want them to prioritize them like this. So what goes to the top of your list as somebody who would support either Trump or Clinton? 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. I'm on Twitter at CarrieNPR, and to Jim in Minneapolis. Hi, Jim. Thanks for waiting.
Yes. Hardly the issue of climate change was hardly mentioned at all in the debates and in the campaigns. And reportedly, Trump does not believe in it, believes it's a hoax. And Hillary mentioned it in passing once. And yet the scientists and many people in the know seem to think that it's the issue facing not only the United States, but the world in the coming years, and that if we don't address energy policy soon or sooner, we will be in grave danger, both in terms of environment and in terms of national security.
Okay, so Mark, I would say that although Jim is correct, Hillary Clinton has been talking about climate change and energy policy on campaign appearances. There hasn't been much discussion about it in those last three debates, but she has a very explicit plan on this, doesn't she?
She does, and you know, she has very explicit plans on virtually every issue. This is the sort of classic image of Hillary Clinton, the policy wonk. She has detailed policies on virtually everything. That said, what is the likelihood that this would be a priority for her administration? Not high at all.
Why?
I think if you look at the last 8 years in President Obama, you had probably the most science-oriented president we've had in many years in this country. And yet he really did not make this a priority at all. And so it's extremely hard to see why a Hillary Clinton would push this out ahead of other much more emotionally appealing issues to many Americans when she's facing a likely hostile Congress, a Congress in which there are a great many members who don't believe in climate change and are hostile to science and and they just don't see this as a priority. And so I just, you know, certainly if Donald Trump is elected, he finds climate change to be little more than a laugh line at his rallies. And in the case of Hillary Clinton, she's got, in her mind, I think, bigger fish to fry. And also she's politically looking at this and saying, you know, is this where I want to make my stand, make my mark? And I haven't seen any sign that that's what she wants to do.
I guess that's the larger question here, Russell, and kind of the thing that we haven't really examined, which is presidents decide how to spend their political capital, right? And as they go all in on a specific issue, they know that means that there will be less political capital to spend on some of the other things that they'd like to get done. Is that how it works?
That's correct. And I think one thing to remember here is Hillary Clinton will be working on two tracks, I think, when it comes to priorities. There will be her legislative priorities, which is what she's going to try to work with Republicans in Congress to get through. And I think those are going to be – infrastructure is going to be at the top of the list, because there's actually some chance of bipartisan cooperation there, especially if they combine it with changes in the corporate tax code. Immigration, as we've mentioned, is going to be another one. Criminal justice reform is one where Republicans have signaled that they want to make changes, as well as Democrats. And then there's going to be a second track, which is the executive actions that she takes, or the policy changes that she initiates through her administration and through the cabinet. And that's where you're going to see climate change be a factor in terms of implementing the Paris Climate Accord to the extent that she can without legislation from Congress. But Mark is right that when it comes to Congress, there's less of a chance of Congress acting on climate change than there is on virtually any other issue, including immigration. And so I would not expect Hillary Clinton to make a big push for Republicans in Congress to address climate change, but she will be looking to do what she can in an executive way, as President Obama did through the EPA and other agencies, to address it.
We have been talking about it. I've been mentioning to listeners here about all the promises that the candidates make on the campaign trail. Here is Hillary Clinton talking about everything she wants to get done in the first 100 days.
Within the first 100 days of our administration, we are going to break the gridlock in Washington and make the biggest investment in new good-paying jobs since World War II.
That's economic, Mark, and an economic challenge that we're actually going to do an individual show on. But she keeps talking about being able to raise the wages of middle-income Americans. That's a very complicated issue, isn't it?
It sure is, and good luck with that. I mean, there's tremendous resistance, as we've seen around the country in various local battles over the minimum wage. There's great resistance to that kind of a change, and certainly in a Republican-led House, you would find great resistance to any change in the minimum wage. If she's talking about trade agreements, renegotiating trade deals, that sort of thing, you know, she has rhetorically adopted some of Bernie Sanders' ideas about trade, but you know, are they really deeply set in her heart? I don't think so. This is not the Hillary Clinton we've seen over most of her career in politics. So, you know, it's hard to imagine her putting that high on her agenda. So, where are these new jobs going to come from? Obviously, she will try to expand technology education around the country and that sort of thing to help people move into the jobs that are available. That's something that a president can do without a whole lot of controversy in Congress. But a president doesn't have a whole lot of tools when it comes to shifting the economy. It's really a lot easier for them to make policy and change administrative priorities in other areas. The economy is something that really presidents struggle to have a big impact on.
Call here from Peter in Cannon Falls. Hi, Peter. Thanks for waiting.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm an independent who was a Sanders supporter, very enthusiastic about it. And so I'm kind of holding my nose while I try and figure out what anything that I like from the two big candidates right now. But I will say that probably one of the very few things I like about Trump is the lobbyist reform. It's actually a bigger extension of Obama's rules. Actually, Clinton has not committed to continuing Obama's rules, and I like the idea of the 5-year prohibition at the top. The other thing is that as far as the divide, I'm hoping that the progressive part of the Democrat Party, the Sanders and the and Elizabeth Warrens, actually hold Clinton's feet to the fire politically. And I think there is some precedent for that.
I think that's an interesting perspective that we haven't talked about yet. Russell, what happens in a Clinton administration when she's got an active and fairly and by the way, they've been out campaigning for her, Sanders and Warren, you know, that wing putting pressure on her?
Yeah, that's going to be a big storyline and a big challenge for Clinton. This is another area where I think she may try to work on two tracks, where she's going to pick some issues where she makes overtures to Republicans in Congress, and then there'll be other things where she clearly has to respond to the concerns of the left. And already we're seeing that the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders wing of the party is putting a big emphasis on personnel in a Clinton administration. They want to see appointments in economic areas like the Treasury Department that will be sort of anti-Wall Street or really holding Wall Street accountable, not former Goldman Sachs bankers who populated the Clinton administration and Republican administrations. And so that's one area where I would very much expect Clinton to respond to them, especially because it could give her some more running room to reach out to Republicans on certain policy areas if she's keeping the left happy by appointing liberals in the executive branch.
Well, we didn't talk about the Supreme Court, so I'm going to have to get to that with our next guest. Mark and Russell, such a pleasure to have you give us your experience and your insight on this. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
thank you.
Mark Fisher with us from The Washington Post. Russell Berman with us from The Atlantic. We're joined now by Reid Galen. He's a Republican strategist who served in the Bush White House with us this morning from Salt Lake City, Utah. Reid, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Daniela Gibbs Leger is with us. She's Senior Vice President for Communications at the Center for American Progress and was a former special assistant to President Obama and with us today from Washington. Daniela, welcome to you. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Hey, here is something for both of you that came up in the last part of the conversation, and it was the Supreme Court. And here's my question to you. Do presidents that have a vacancy to fill as they come in to an administration, do they feel an urgency to start in very quickly with a list of names on that? Or is there a time of congressional temperature taking where they're trying to figure out, you know, which nominee might be acceptable? Daniela, what would you say?
You know, I would think maybe in a normal election cycle that, yes, you would take a little bit of time to, you know, to see what Congress is thinking and talk to your advisors. But given where we are with this, you know, Supreme Court vacancy being open for so long, with so much controversy around the fact that people are saying they're not going to, you know, appoint anybody if Hillary Clinton happens to win, something tells me that among the first things that she's going to do is either, you know, put up a new nominee or say that they need to go ahead and put Garland through.
And you believe that just because this is something that she's going to feel like can't wait?
I mean, okay. if you look at just what's been happening at the Supreme Court, a couple of cases that have been decided 4-4 because they don't have, you know, the 9-person, you know, court that they normally do. And there are a couple of cases that are going to be coming forward that you really want a full court there. I don't think that people feel like we can just wait for a couple of weeks before they move on this issue.
Reid, what's your assessment of that?
Sure. Well, I think a lot has to do with the outcome of the Senate races next week.
Ah,
if there
mm-hmm.
is a Democratic Senate, and it sounds like that the you know members of the Democratic leadership there say they very well may do away with the filibuster that has for so long held up a lot of either you know legislation generally or judicial appointments specifically. So, and we can't overlook the fact that maybe again if the Republicans lose the Senate, they may try and just get Garland through. You know, in the lame duck, but that's a whole other thing. I think that, yes, Secretary Clinton would push to get that done quickly, and I do believe that Senate Democrats, should they be in the majority, would probably get rid of that filibuster if it's Garrett, Merrick,
Merrick
get
Garland,
him a,
yeah.
Merrick Garland, yeah, Merrick Garland, renominated and pushed through and have the court, you know, full for their next term, next summer.
Okay, so let me ask you this then about that, which is that, as we suggested in the last part of the discussion, presidents have to decide, and their staffs have to decide, how they will use presidential political capital. You're going to have to spend some capital to get a Supreme Court nominee through a potentially resistant Congress. So, Daniela, how does that calculation go?
You know, I think all presidents and all administrations, they are balancing literally 100 China plates on their arms when they come in at the beginning. And, you know, who knows what else is going to be happening in the world when January 20th rolls around. And I think a lot depends on, you know, like Reed said, what happens with the Senate. And also, if Garland isn't pushed through the lame duck and it is Merrick Garland, I don't know that you really have to expend that much political capital for a Merrick Garland. There's a reason why President Obama nominated him, I think. I don't know. I haven't talked to him about it personally. But, you know, he was somebody who had been approved unanimously by the Senate. He was very popular with Republicans just until President Obama nominated him for the Supreme Court. So, you know, I don't think that he would necessarily be somebody that she'd have to spend a lot of political capital on.
And Reed, overall on this question of political capital, talk to me about how a president thinks about it and how the staff thinks and advises on it. You know, you're gonna have to use this to get this done, Mr. President or Mrs. President, Madam President, and that means you may not get this done. How does that go?
Well, I mean, I think that this is such a unique situation. If we believe that, if we believe the latest surveys that Secretary Clinton will be elected, you know, they have such a unique perspective on things because she has been there, obviously. Former President Clinton has been there. This is not their first time around the ring. So they have, I think, a much better idea of what it is they think they can get done. And, you know, White Houses, much like campaigns, are all reflections of their presidents. And so it's going to start with whatever vision the next president has, whether or not that's Secretary Clinton or Donald Trump, and go forth from there. Now, with Secretary Clinton, you know, we've heard numerous times whether or not it's tax, corporate tax reform mixed with some sort of infrastructure plan, whatever the case might be. With Donald Trump, his vision is, I don't know what that vision even looks like at this point, but but you know, so they're going to take those things and say, okay, we know we basically have 12 months to get this done. We've got 12 months of a, you know, very close Senate. And, you know, potentially a much narrower majority for Republicans in the House. And if it's not done by early 2018, when the midterms start up again, it's going to be very difficult because all of those Republicans who, you know, are in swing districts are going to want to show that they stood up to Hillary Clinton. You're going to have a whole bunch of Republican senators who are up for reelection, a bunch of Republican Senate nominees who are going to want to show that they are going to continue intransigence as part of, you know, the Republican creed and the Republican brand. So she's got about a year, at least in my political calculus, to really get something big done before the politics of a midterm, which are always very difficult for first-term presidents, you know, takes hold. And then they're just buffeted by those forces for the next 9-10 months.
Daniela, that's really interesting to think about how President Obama handled that then. Also knowing that the clock was ticking from the very beginning and he'd made some big promises and he wanted to get a lot done. And he had to choose, didn't he, between health care reform, something he talked a lot about on the campaign trail, and immigration reform, something he'd also talked a lot about. How did that decision get made? What would you say?
Right. And you also have to remember that the economy was losing 700,000 to 800,000 jobs a month.
Right.
I think a lot of people forget how bad the situation was when President Obama came into office. So it wasn't just the things that he said he wanted to do on a campaign trail that he had to weigh the balance of. It was, you know, the auto industry that was, you know, barely, you know, at that point, it wasn't even recovering, and an economy that was about to fall off the cliff. So getting that stimulus package through was really the most important priority in explaining and showing why it was necessary in order to turn the economy back around. So, you know, hopefully, you know, our economy, knock on wood, is doing much better now. So Secretary Clinton, as she is the president, will not have those type of headwinds, you know, walking into her first term. But that definitely shaped what happened in the first year of President Obama's presidency. And it is sort of sad but true what Reid said about you have about a year before it turns to the politics of the midterms. And that's just unfortunately the way things are.
You're absolutely right to remind me that there was this huge economic issue to address from the moment, even before he got into office, he had to be thinking about what that was going to be. Mm-hmm. How do you think then getting that stimulus package through, how do you think that did influence then, as he looked back on his list of priorities, what he would go to next?
Well, you know, I think that you want to talk about spending political capital, despite the fact that we were in such dire straits there. It took a lot of political capital to get that through, even with Democrats holding slim majorities. Because, you know, just anytime you're going to spend that much money or infuse that much money, you know, there are going to be people who are going to, you know, say, you're not spending it the right way. It's too much money. We don't trust the government to be in charge of this. So it took a lot of work from every part of the White House, from working members of Congress to working governors and you know, mayors, because they're the ones who are really suffering with this and trying to figure out how to get their economies back, and they've got to balance their budgets and all of that. So I think, you know, once you used up a lot of the political capital for that, then getting through immigration reform was going to be really hard. And by the time we got through that, because, you know, healthcare came first, you know, it passed the Senate. People forget, you know, a comprehensive immigration reform, bipartisan, yep, passed the Senate. Right. But the House had become so entrenched and so taken over by the Tea Party wing that, you know, John Boehner just felt like he could never bring the bill to the floor. And even if he did, it would have passed because there were enough Republicans to side with the Democrats that we could have had immigration reform. But he was afraid of putting that bill on the floor and what it would do to the Republican caucus.
And Reid, is that the Hastert rule that you have to have? Yeah.
Yeah. Majority of the majority to bring it to the floor. Yeah.
And so as you know that, of course, that President Bush, the president you served, wanted to do something about immigration reform.
Absolutely.
Again, this is a big issue in this election. Can you see a way to avoid some of the pitfalls that Presidents Bush and Obama ran into, and a new way maybe to get something done?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, as we talk about this, I think if you go back and think about President Obama, that remember that he got, I believe that the Affordable Care Act passed in early 2010.
Okay.
And, you know, we're now 6 years later, about, you know, the end of his term. That will be his signature thing. You know, a year into his presidency, his signature piece of legislation was done.
Wow.
He had another 7 years left in office. and that was it, right? Because of, you know, the follow-on effect of passing Obamacare was loses, you know, the Senate loses the House, and, you know, they're just not going to cooperate. Frankly, that was a two-way street, but we're not going to argue about that now. I think, though, for, you know, President Clinton or President Trump, whoever they might be, you know, it's a much bit different thing because they will be buffeted by people who are actively trying to help them fail.
Okay, right now, explain that. What do you mean by
that? Well, because you know, there is such – I mean, disliking the Clintons is a core piece of Republican ideology in America, okay, whether or not it's the average voter, whether or not it's a member of Congress. And given Secretary Clinton's issues with the email and the continuing WikiLeaks stuff, it's just one of those things where you even heard, you know, the House Oversight Chair Jason Chaffetz from here in Utah saying, like, I'm going to be looking into her literally from the day she takes office. And so that there's not only the what do I want to do as president, but then also taking all of this incoming fire. Now, when President Obama took office, he took office in such a time of dire straits for the country and in such a transformative way that he had, a really high tide. Right. He had a supermajority in the Senate. He had the House. And so it was a different time. Right. He was able to come in on the upswing despite how deep in the doldrums the country was itself. Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, very divided country. You know, whether or not the economy is doing – the economy is no doubt doing better. Still, a lot of people don't feel like it's doing, you know, well enough. And so both of these candidates, should they be elected, are going to be suffering from a lot of incoming fire as they try and push out proactive policy positions.
Daniela Reid, we're going to continue our conversation after our 10 o'clock news break here. But I want to say what Reid just said is the reason that people – throw up their hands or hang their heads in despair. Mm-hmm. This idea that from the very beginning, that's how it begins. So, Daniela, think about that And we'll pick that up on the other side of news here. And if you've just tuned in to the conversation, on this 1 week out from Election Day, we've got some special coverage here, joined by Reid Gayle and Daniela Gibbs Leger, to talk to us, both of whom served in White Houses, served presidents, about what this is like as a new president comes into the White House and has this long list of priorities and promises, how they order and organize that agenda, the prevailing winds that blow against them, as Reid just suggests, how they get what they can get done in the amount of time really, really allotted to them, and why that is such a short amount of time. All that on the other side of news. Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this hour we're continuing special coverage 7 days out from Election Day. We're contemplating the promises the candidates have made and what it takes to fulfill those promises. We're also getting glimpses behind the scenes in a White House as the president's team tries to help him or her enact those promises. Daniela Gibbs Leger is with us. She's a former special assistant to President Obama and now senior VP for communications at the Center for American Progress. And Reid Gayle continues with us, a Republican strategist who served in the Bush White House. Daniela, before we went to news, Reid was giving us what I'm sure is the truth, that the obstructionism, the pushback begins almost from the beginning. How does a president meet that and try to work around that?
Yeah, I definitely agree with your assessment that this is what causes people to say, I really just don't like anyone in Washington, D.C.,
right,
and I don't like politics at all. You know, the fact that, you know, some Republicans are already, you know, saying or being very clear about what their obstruction plans will be is disheartening. But you know what? I have faith. Maybe I'm a little naive. I'm trying to hold on to some sort of hope in this very dark election cycle. There's going to be that obstruction that's there to Secretary Clinton, assuming she wins. Reid is right. There is sort of a cottage industry on the right of hating the Clintons going back for decades. But there is this desire in this country to see something get done. And if there are even just a few things where there is some level of agreement, like Republicans and Democrats say we need to do something about our crumbling infrastructure. The American people say we need to do something. Perhaps there is something that can be done. And perhaps Republicans who maybe their inclination will be towards obstruction will say, actually, I need to show that I am capable of governing. Because after just throwing up and saying no for, you know, 8 years, maybe that won't work anymore. And I need to show that, yes, on things that are really important to the American people, we can work with the other party to get something done. And maybe, you know, it falls within that year period. And after that year, all bets are off. But I'm hopeful that something can get done in the beginning, because I think it behooves both parties to show that actually they are capable of getting some things done here, or else in 2 years it's going to be throw everybody out.
You know, Reid, I know that one person's obstructionism is another person standing firm on party principles, right? But what do you think, take that and then put what Daniela just said up against that with your knowledge that this drives voters crazy?
Sure. I mean, I think that what we've already seen a little bit since Speaker Ryan took over after Speaker Boehner stepped aside, is that he has already, you know, had to go across to Leader Pelosi several times to, you know, cobble together enough votes because he couldn't get the Freedom Caucus, you know, the self-styled Freedom Caucus, the very, you know, right wing. I think they've even surpassed Tea Partyism now. I don't even know what they'd be called at this point. But I don't think we're going to see that change. I think if there's one thing we know about former President Clinton and certainly current, you know, Secretary Clinton, is that they are very savvy political operators. Mm-hmm. They know that if they want to get a deal done, they are going to have to give something up to Republicans or to conservatives that is likely to drive their base crazy. But that is something that they have been willing to do in order to get something major done in Congress. And it would not surprise me if they know that whether or not it's, you know, again, the infrastructure reform / corporate tax reform – you know, or infrastructure construction, excuse me, that, you know, Ryan will see an offer that is too good to pass up, or really close to too good to pass up. And if he has to go and get Democratic votes, which will likely be there because they will want to help President Clinton, you know, that very well might happen. I think, you know, for all of the talk of, well, you know, Paul Ryan won't do something because he has his own aspirations for 2020. I think that's a pretty craven political outlook. I mean, you know, maybe it's true, but I don't believe it. I believe that Speaker Ryan, whether you agree with him on policy or not, is a dedicated public servant. And if he believed that there was something that was both good for, you know, the job creators of America and something that was going to help put people back to work, I think that that's something he would take a hard look at.
In light of what Reid and Daniela have just said about this idea of obstructionism and working together, I'm going to ask you, as you listen to our conversation as it continues, can you give, as a voter, the new president the benefit of the doubt for a short amount of time, even if that president is someone from a different party from which you support? So as a voter who may have voted for the person that didn't win, can you give the new president the benefit of the doubt in the service of trying to get something done? Think about that as voters, and then call us and tweet in. I'm curious about your thoughts on this. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at @CarrieNPR. And then, Daniela, let me ask you this about that question I'm putting out there. Does it... We know that there's hardcore bases, and they're going to probably stand firm no matter what happens. But the rest, the centrist part of America, is their interest in getting something done able to influence parties that have to be nudged off of their, you know, off of their obstructionist ways?
I would like to hope so. I think a lot will depend on the outcome of this election. I think, unfortunately, if either person wins in a landslide, that could mean less incentive to try and, you know, work with the other side. I don't see that happening, actually, in either instance. I think regardless of who the candidates are, this is still pretty closely divided electorate, and it's going to be a close election no matter what. But I do think that there is an opportunity for folks to make their voices heard and say, look, we're putting you on notice. And this has been, you know, one of the ugliest elections we've ever lived through. But now we're expecting you to step beyond that and put the benefit of the American people ahead of everything. And if you can't do that, then there will be consequences at the ballot box. Will it work? I don't know. But again, I'm going to hold on to a little bit of hope that it actually will.
What do you think, Reid?
I'd like to have a little bit of that hope. I think what we're also going to see is, an American people, an electorate who, you know, whether or not you're a Republican, a Democrat, independent, you know, these are two of the least popular nominees in modern political history, if not in the nation. But we don't think we have research that goes back that far. And so what I think you're also going to see is an opportunity for candidates and people outside the traditional political duopoly who are going to be able to start standing for election. And they may not win in 2018 and they may not win in 2020. But given that, you know, the two-party system at this point is not getting a heck of a lot done at the federal level for the American people, right, I would say that you could start seeing, you know, voters looking for another choice. And I don't necessarily think that's altogether a bad thing.
So are you talking about third parties or because,
you know, I don't know if it's going to be a third party per se. I think it'll probably be something that's more on a district by district or state by state basis. And they might be independents. Remember, in the United States Senate, it doesn't take too many independents who, you know, decide to caucus on their own to really start to create a block where neither party can get something done without them. And maybe that's, you know, the so-called saucer we need to, you know, start cooling the tea.
We had a call here from Doug in Winona who notes that in the last 10 years, Congress doesn't seem to be able to work on more than one issue at a time. And he says, what's wrong with the committee structure? Is the structure of the committee work so dysfunctional that it has basically ground to a halt as well? Daniela, do you know?
You know, that's a really good question, and I don't know that I know the answer, but I can speculate because, you know, I live in D.C. and that's what we do. If we don't know the answer to something, I'll give you my opinion anyway.
All right.
I think over the last 10 years, what you've seen is a lack of cooperation, what we've been talking about before, just a lack of willingness to sort of work across party lines. And I think that comes from when you send people from very gerrymandered districts where they're being elected by a group of people who, where there's not a lot of diversity of thought and opinion, and they feel like they have to toe the line to the folks who elected them, and they're worried about maybe getting challenged from the right more often than getting challenged from the left, that when they get on these committees, there's no desire to actually try and work together with the people.
Really?
Yeah, to work with the Democrats or Republicans across the aisle. And I think that's really the biggest problem with Congress is that, you know, we, I mean the American people, sent a bunch of people to Congress who have the idea that government is broken and they're going to do everything that they can to, like, make government not work. And then we're surprised when government doesn't work. Well, these are the people that we elected, so, and they're just doing what they said they were going to do, which is to, you know, throw a monkey wrench into everything. So it's not surprising that over the past decade you've seen sort of, especially at the committee level, where things were generally more congenial, sort of grind to a halt.
Reed, doesn't that idea that Daniela raised, government's broken, we really, you know, we need to starve it, pare it down, I mean, that goes back to Newt Gingrich. What do you do, or maybe even before, what do you do when you have a President Bush, as the one you served, who needs government to be able to work to get his agenda done? How do those two ideas work?
Well, I mean, I think that as you know, over the past, you know, whatever, you know, President Obama, President Bush, the, you know, I think probably starting post 9/11, you know, which was such a shock to the national core, you know, we started looking to the federal government for what at least as a you know, small government, you know, conservative sort of libertarian, whatever I am, is the first job of government is to protect its people, right? And so suddenly then what you saw was not only were we looking to the government to protect us, now we have the Department of Homeland Security, now we have, you know, No Child Left Behind. So, you know, ironically enough, we saw, a massive, you know, massive growth in the scope of the federal government under President George W. Bush that, you know, was probably unexpected. But again, nobody expected something like 9/11. And then we had the economic collapse where we have massive federal infusion of funds into the financial sector to sort of prop it up and keep it from collapsing. And so now what we see is, because we see that there is gridlock at all levels for the most part, probably aside from your city council, that, you know, okay, you know, wages have stagnated. The job that I once had does not exist. It will not exist ever again. You know, my kids are leaving. My kids are not going to have as good a life as I have. Somebody has got to explain this to me. You know, my neighbor's not going to explain it to me. My mayor's not going to explain it to me.
Right.
So the president darn well better explain it to me, and Congress better help fix it. And I think that is something that, you know, again, we're just in this really untethered, unidentified political epoch in this country where nothing is as it seems. I mean, if you think about, go back to this past summer, you know, one night of the Democratic National Committee when they're talking about national security could have been a Republican National Convention night or 8 years ago. So we are just completely, you know, topsy-turvy as to what people both of, on the left and the right believe government should do. And remember that you only believe in small government so long as the things the government actually does, you know, you support.
That's so true. To the phones to Michael in St. Paul. Hey, Michael, hi. Hi, Michael, are you there? We might have missed him. To Bill in Minneapolis. Hi, Bill. Thanks for waiting.
Hi there.
Hi.
Good morning.
What are you thinking about?
Well, my understanding of your question is, well, in my case, I'm a avid supporter of Hillary Clinton. However, if Donald Trump is elected president and he proposes some massive infrastructure project to improve our airports and highways, et cetera, I would write to my congressman, and depending on how it was financed, I would be very supportive.
Okay.
As opposed to just saying, well, I didn't vote for him, so therefore I'm going to oppose everything that he proposes.
Right. That makes sense. I mean, Daniela, and that kind of voter input to members of Congress does make a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah, we would definitely need more people like this caller to, you know, call their members. People sometimes think, oh, those things don't really make a difference. They very much do. Members take note of the people who call into their office, who write into their office, who visit their office. So, you know, I would hope, you know, if you're a Hillary Clinton supporter and Donald Trump wins, and like this gentleman says, he proposes an infrastructure package that is good, that you would support, that you would encourage your member of Congress, be they Democrat or Republican, to support it, because at the end of the day, you want what's best for the American people, and it really shouldn't matter what form that comes in, be it a Democrat or a Republican.
I want to ask you both, this is kind of an insider question, and since you've both been insiders, you're the right people to ask it of. What happens when a president has to, what I think of as cut bait on a promise that they really want to fulfill? And I'm, and it becomes clear to everyone around the president that they're just not going to be able to get that done, and yet the president is kind of hanging on to it. Daniela, one of the things I'm thinking about is Guantanamo Bay. For a lot of reasons, President Obama has not been able to close Guantanamo, and his staff probably knew that this was, and yet he continues to talk about it. I mean, how does a president and how does his staff decide that's just not a promise you're going to be able to do? Pay attention to this other stuff that you might be able to get done.
Yeah, I think that one especially hurts for a lot of people who are really committed to seeing it shut down. Although I would note that, you know, the number of people who are actually in Guantanamo now compared to when he took office is dramatically less. So yes, sort of by attrition, it is closing. Okay. And Congress has a lot to do, unfortunately, with why it's still open. That's not just all on the president. But I think you have to weigh the calculus. And I don't think that's a bad thing, like in a craven political sense. But, you know, the president has to be able to walk and chew gum, to be cliche about it. And, you know, you have to be able to juggle multiple priorities. And at some point, one thing is going to move ahead of something else, and you are going to upset somebody for whom the issue that's moving to the back burner, that is their pet issue, and that is what they care about, and they wake up every morning thinking about how we're going to close Guantanamo Bay. And, you know, the president has to, you know, understand and deal with the fact that you are never going to please all of the people all the time, and there's always going to be a group of your supporters who are going to be upset with you about something, but you have to run the entire country, and you have to make decisions based on what's good for everybody. And if that means that, you know, one of the priorities that you put out when you're running for office isn't feasible or needs to, you know, like I said, move to the back bench while you focus on something else, then that's what you have to do. That's why you're president of the United States, because you get to make those extremely tough decisions.
Reed, was there a decision that President Bush or an issue that he really wanted to accomplish, that it became clear to you and others around him it just wasn't going to happen?
Well, I mean, I think at least in the first term, everything got pushed aside by the war on terror, and
yeah,
then ultimately Iraq. And I think that was pretty much, you know, the basis of the rest of his presidency. Obviously, after his reelection in 2004, there was a brief push for entitlement reform, which went absolutely nowhere. As you mentioned, in 2006, 2007, he did try and push for immigration reform. But again, at that point, that just, you know, the presidential race had started. It just was, there was no political will. I mean, I would say, though, you know, let's, you know, bring this conversation, you know, to the present and to the slight future on, mm-hmm, you know, who do you have to upset to get things done? I think the infrastructure thing is a really good example of that. If a President Clinton wants to get infrastructure done, we are talking about millions of tons of concrete and millions of gallons of diesel fuel that are going to push bulldozers all over the place. And the environmental community is going to have a lot of problems with that.
Uh-huh.
And at some point, she is going to have to say, guys, I love you, and I'm with you. And I want to have a carbon-free future as much as you do. But you know what, guys? Bulldozers don't run on solar panels. And
not
so
yet.
They are going to want – not yet. And it would have to be one heck of a solar panel. But – the point is that the environmental community will want to put in place many, many rules and regulations that basically slow the process such that, you know, the environmental impact of these things is negligible, which the practical result is the bridge doesn't get fixed, the road doesn't get built, et cetera, et cetera. So that, to me, that would be a practical example of something you were just talking about.
That's a good one. And Daniela, I'm thinking of President Obama's education plan. He had to upset teachers' unions to get done on education what he tried to get done, didn't he?
Yeah, that's right. And on that note, though, I do think that initially they were upset, but then the Obama administration also realized that you need to work with teachers in order to have like the success that you need. So as they moved on with Race to the Top and other initiatives, you saw them incorporating teachers more into the process at the beginning as they're rolling their programs out. So, you know, with this example of, you know, infrastructure, I would encourage the administration to sit down with the environmental groups at the beginning to say, this is what we're thinking of doing. Here are their concerns. And then where you have to say, okay, well, this, we can do this, but we can't do these other things that you want to do because we need to move this forward. I think as long as we're at the table at the beginning, you can possibly avoid some issues that you normally might run into.
Do you two think that a president's accomplishments are best viewed basically in hindsight from a distance? Is it really hard to see, you know, the consequence of those decisions and accomplishments or lack thereof in real time? Danielle?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, that expression about hindsight being 2020 is, it's there for a reason. And I think when you are in it, when you are living the day-to-day battles, it's very hard to sometimes be objective about the success or the failure of things that either you're working on or things that your opponent is doing. So I do think that, you know, most presidencies tend to look better with the passage of time. I think, you know, some just were bad and they're going to stay bad forever no matter what. But I do think that, you know, President Obama's presidency will be more properly judged with some space.
Reed, what would you say?
I think that's right. I mean, I think there is the near term review. If you look at, you know, President George W. Bush, whether you agree with many of the things he did or not, you know, this was a president who left office, you know, in the low mid 30s as far as approval ratings concerned. Just, you know, not even 8 years out of office. You know, he's already tipping the scales above 50%. But that's a different calculation than legacy. I think, you know, that one of the presidents who history has been kind to, I think, would be a Harry Truman, mm-hmm. who when he left office was sort of universally reviled. And now looking back, you know, is seen as, you know, someone who was both a practical Democrat and a bridge between, you know, two different sides of a world. Right. The World War II, pre-World War II, current World War II, and then post-war election, and also served as a bridge between two giants of their age, Franklin Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower. So I think that, yeah, the passage of decades, I think, certainly does help. It certainly takes away, I think, that sheen of hyper-partisanship and anger. But, you know, presidents, as we've talked about, you know, there's a reason why so many of these folks, you know, and they have been men up to this point, you know, there's very good chance it'll be a woman now, start out with dark hair and end up with white hair, you know, when they leave office.
Exactly.
Reed, Daniela, this has been so insightful to have the benefit of your experience and your knowledge. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's been great to be on.
Thank you.
Daniela Gibbs-Leger, Senior VP for Communications at the Center for American Progress. She was formerly a special assistant to President Obama. And Reed Galen, a Republican strategist, served in the Bush White House.